It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our summer music series, Set List, where we hear interviews and exclusive musical performances from Wisconsin artists. Today we'll feature the Madison psychedelic rock band, Dolores.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
The state has filed lawsuits against more businesses that received loans from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We'll learn about those loans and why the state is suing the companies.
And new reports show that changes to Wisconsin's open records laws initially came from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. We'll discuss what we've learned about that proposal.
Right now we're joined by Jason Stein, the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with new information on the WEDC. What do we learn about these new companies that the agency is now suing?
Right. Well, again, the lawsuits are happening because the state has loaned money to companies that's not being paid back or hasn't entirely been paid back. And what we're learning is that in three of these cases, significant sums of money were loaned out to companies that have been accused of impropriety in one way or another, and including, you know, one that appears to be under criminal scrutiny from law enforcement.
And what do we know about how these companies were awarded money and escaped the scrutiny of the WEDC?
It's a couple of different things. In two of the cases, what the WEDC has told me, you know, or produced in its records, is that these financial problems with the company were not turned up in their review. And these would be cases where the company did not disclose financial problems that either the company itself, people on its board, officers of the company had. They didn't disclose those problems to the state, and then the state did not turn them up, didn't do the kind of financial checks that they needed to do to turn those up. And then in another case, there was a lawsuit in which one of the company owner or company president, a judge in the lawsuit found that his business dealings in other areas had all the earmarks of fraud. That's the judge's words. And although the WEDC was aware of that case, they did, you know, the agency did go ahead and make the $1 million loan to that businessman, to his business.
And Jason, can you frame this for us? There's been a bit of a laundry list in the past months of bad news from the WEDC as regards companies that got money and issues therein. How big a deal is this latest news?
Well, you know, again, I would leave that to your listeners to decide. But, you know, this is a case where you had $500,000 awards being made to companies, and either one, basic checks such as, you know, an independent verification of, you know, the financial strength of the company and its owners and officers was not performed, or, you know, in this other case, the agency was aware of this lawsuit, which had some alarming information in it, and went ahead and made the award anyway. And it's not clear to me if the agency just didn't know what the real details of the lawsuit were, or if they did know them, but felt for whatever reason that they could go ahead and make you know, such a large loan anyway.
We're talking with Jason Stein, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're going to change gears now as we talk about the latest in state news from the week and talk about what we learned about changes to open record laws. And this was a big deal a couple weeks ago.
Right.
As a proposal in the budget, we didn't know where that proposal had come from, and it was pushed back. But what do we know now? What's the latest?
Sure. The Wisconsin State Journal and our newspaper have reported a couple things in recent days. First, that the part of these open records changes came from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's office, that he requested something called legislative privilege that would have made it more difficult for the public to get information about work that was being done in legislative offices, including in cases of lawsuits. It would be the lawmakers would have more ability to prevent information from being disclosed in lawsuits by themselves or by their employees about the work that was being done in the office. And then as well, we also reported in today's paper that Governor Scott Walker's administration is saying that it does not have to release certain records, even though, you know, the governor has said making a similar change, actually putting that change into the open records law would be a mistake.
Now, it sounds as though the governor had said that when a law or when some material is deemed deliberative in nature, that's the phrase that he's used to say that maybe sometimes you don't have to release it.
Right. And so sort of what's at issue here is when they say deliberative, what that refers to, at least as I understand it, is the back and forth exchange of ideas that would happen internally, within the administration or another unit of government about, you know, a policy that's being developed and that eventually gets released to the public, and that the argument being made is that to allow for the free exchange of ideas, the government officials should not have to disclose the ideas that they trade back and forth, but maybe don't make it into the final proposal that goes out before the public.
And what has the governor's office had to say?
Well, again, the governor, the governor's office was involved in putting together this open records proposal, which was passed by the legislature's budget committee and then very quickly taken out by the lawmakers after there was a lot of public outcry about it. The governor has said that was a mistake. But again, at the same time, the governor's administration has rejected certain records requests declined to provide certain records on this basis of this deliberative privilege. And what the open records attorneys that we've interviewed, from outside the administration say is that there's nothing explicitly in state law that would allow for withholding records for that.
Jason, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That was Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, helping us review the headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look back on the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
First, we continue our summer music series called Setlist. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. You can hear them every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Madison's psychedelic rockers Dolores came to the WPR studios to play some new songs from their latest album, Peach Fuzz, and talk about how the band was spawned from an impromptu jam session at a music store.
All right. Does somebody have a van? Wait, don't tell me the new guy has the van.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you've got the van. Yeah, you can play drums with us.
Essentially.
That's it. First of all, you guys, thanks a lot for coming into the studio and playing for us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I want to get the origin story to start off with. Javi, but other people jump in. How did you guys get together as a band?
I met Adam at a music store in Minneapolis. He's just playing the bass behind me. He was, like, playing with me. And it was cool. And he's good. And so I went over and I was like, hey, let me get your number. I asked him for his number before I asked him for his name. It was funny.
All you've got to do is let me know.
And then we played around a little bit in Minneapolis. Nothing really serious because I was just on break in Minneapolis when I met him because I went to school at UW. But then his fiance got into a master's program here, and so they moved here, and so me and him started playing together. And then I met Willie through a couple different connections, and then Teddy joined up.
Eddie, Teddy.
Same thing. Joined up later.
Yeah, all this serendipity. Adam, you know, you meet this stranger in the music store. He asked for your number. I mean, did you instantly have a sense like, hey, I kind of clicked musically with this guy?
Yeah, I definitely was the creepy guy that decided to start playing along. I think Javi was playing on a banjo or...
I don't know music store etiquette. Is that cool? You're playing in a music store, somebody sits down and starts playing?
I love that. I've always done that with the people that are around me at music stores, and I think that they think I'm encroaching on their solo jam. But yeah, I really liked it when he was doing that.
I had only been in Minneapolis for maybe a month or two when that happened, and I was looking to play music there, and so it seemed to just click a little bit. Got lucky meeting somebody that way.
And then, Willie, you're on board. You're here in Madison. Correct me if I'm wrong, but all you guys, when I watch you here, I've watched you a little bit online, I get this notion you're having a lot of fun doing this. Is that part of what it's all about?
Lots of fun playing music.
Uh-huh. Too much fun, ever?
Can't have too much fun playing music.
And Teddy, you're... Eddie? No, Teddy.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah. No. So you're kind of like the hired gun as the drummer. Was it easy to fit in with these guys?
The new guy.
The new guy? The new kid?
It was kind of intimidating at first, honestly.
Because they had their stuff, and you had learned their stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd been listening to Nectar Fields, their first EP that the three of them put together for like months before I actually joined the band. I knew they were from Madison, and I heard they were looking for a drummer.
Didn't you think we were, like, old guys? Or did I make that up?
You guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were, like, 29, 30. Yeah, I did.
Old guys, and you thought they were 29?
I guess.
I'll invite the public radio audience to close their ears at this juncture. So Nectar Fields is the already existing EP, and you're working on another one, Peach Fuzz. What's growing? What's evolving in this new project you're working on?
Well, we flipped around, but like the way we did Nectar Fields is we like layered, like he would do drums and he'd do lead guitar afterwards, and he would play bass and then he would do synth afterwards. And then
it's hard to recreate live.
Though. So we needed like another soldier. So yeah, it's different because now Willie is only playing bass, and he still does guitar on there because we gotta have that. And Teddy's playing drums and doing a little singing. And
I think the sound in general is like a little harder, a little harsher.
Okay.
Yeah.
By hard, you mean a little more, I don't know, rockin' or?
Yeah, just more rockin'.
Yeah, it's way more rockin'.
Do you have an ETA, an inception date for Peach Fuzz, when that'll be?
When it's done? when it's done being mastered.
It's all recorded, it's all mixed, and we're just waiting for masters to come back. So
masters to masters.
It's in production.
We weren't very organized, so we don't have an official release date. We think when we get it done, it'll just kind of appear online.
So what is success for a musician these days? What is success for you guys? It's, you know, in the old days, you sell a lot of albums, you get bigger crowds at the show. Now there's social media. People can get your stuff online. Do you have a bar where it's like, yeah, this is where I want to be. Yeah. We made it when we hit this point.
I think being able to make a living off of it, that would be ideal for me.
Yeah. Same. I don't think we have like a certain number of records we're trying to like sell
sure.
or anything like that.
And touring in and out of Wisconsin, what do you guys have on the agenda?
Right now we're working on booking some Midwest shows.
Van or convoy, or how are you traveling?
buggy.
Van.
Does somebody have a van? Wait, don't tell me the new guy has the van.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you've got the van. Yeah, you can play drums with us.
Essentially.
That's it.
That's another obstacle to overcome. So.
Yeah, the glamour of the musical lifestyle. Guys, thanks a lot for coming into the studio today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
That was Madison Band Dolores. Since, by the way, the time this interview was recorded, the band has officially called it quits. I hope it wasn't me. It was an amicable breakup, we hear. They played their last show 2 days ago in Madison. I guess that's rock and roll.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs on Central Time Fridays at 4:15 through early September. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Next Friday on Setlist, we'll feature the Oshkosh rock band The Traveling Suitcase.
A few of the bands we featured so far on this series were included in the lineup at last week's inaugural Eau Claire's Music and Arts Festival. The festival drew more than 20,000 music fans to the banks of the Chippewa River just outside of Eau Claire. And one of those music fans is WPR's very own Jane Rotunda. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jane, why did you want to go to this particular festival?
I was excited that it was in Wisconsin, and, you know, it was, from the beginning, the communication and the approach for promotions was just, it felt very different. It felt very warm and welcoming and less commercial. So I was excited about that. And, of course, Justin Vernon and Bon Iver was a factor. They've been on hiatus from playing for a few years, so it was great to see them.
And what were a few of your musical highlights that you saw there?
Rather than picking a show, because that was just too hard, I loved the collaboration. There were artists sharing the stage with other performers throughout the entire festival. Blind Boys of Alabama, which is a gospel group, joined a folk rock group, Blown Bellow. S. Carey had the UW Eau Claire Jazz Ensemble on stage with them. And yeah, it was great to see so many people collaborating and working together and enjoying the music. And the No BS Brass Band was also awesome. They were parading around the grounds all festival and up on stage with so many different groups. They were great.
And you were collaborative, and I just anecdotally talking to some folks from WPR who went, they said that there was the spirit of collaboration, and Justin Vernon himself was talking about lots of language about love and only having each other as people, that it was sort of emotional. Did you find it emotional like that?
It was emotional. There was this feeling of community and just really celebrating people and music and what beautiful things people can create together when they, you know, work on this amazing big project. And it was definitely fun and friendly and really great.
Yeah, talking to bands in our music series, the people who are in now or in the past part of the Eau Claire music scene talk about this incredible community. In one case, how they felt lost when they moved too far away from it. Did you get that feeling from maybe local fans there, that they felt like they were part of this community along with all the musicians?
Yes, definitely. There was very much a sense of pride for Eau Claire and Wisconsin. And Eau Claire is an amazing place for fostering musicians. It's, you know, brought a lot of great music to the state and then beyond. So I think there was a sense of pride and excitement.
And did you get the sense that this was a big draw outside of Wisconsin? Were people crossing state lines to get to this?
Yes. I actually read in an article there were about 1,000 people from outside the states as well, and people represented from every state. So
what did you miss any of the shows you'd been hoping to see, or did you make it? Did you have your itinerary ready and you caught all the acts you wanted to see?
I did. I printed out the lineup and I did some highlighting and some planning. to make sure I saw the acts that I really wanted to see. And then I also just, you know, let myself pick something randomly and explore. And it was very approachable in that sense. And also they staggered the times for the shows on all the different stages. So you were able to see a little bit of everything almost always.
Did you get the sense that any stars were born at this festival, the way they sometimes are at, you know, say, South by Southwest?
Well, one surprising act that I didn't know a lot about was Francis and the Lights. And I don't know, they might be stars already, but they were super captivating. They put on a great show, and they were an act that I didn't know anything about and ended up really enjoying.
And a risk of any outdoor festival, the weather. And I know there were chances of rain, I think, that weekend. Did you ever have to run for cover?
Actually, there was a storm on Friday night, and we were camping, and we were instructed to bend down the hatches and get in our cars and sleep for a couple hours because there were some pretty high winds and thunder, and it was exciting, you know? It was like this middle of the night adventure and excitement, and then it was over, and it was beautiful during the day. Sunny, very hot, but sunny and really fun.
Sounds like summer in Wisconsin. Well, Jane, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. It's my pleasure.
That was Jane Rotonda, Development Specialist here at WPR, talking about the Eau Claire's Music and Arts Festival.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at President Obama's call for common sense gun laws. He says that's the biggest unfinished business of his presidency.
First, the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act is coming up this Sunday. In 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush signed the ADA, giving civil rights protections to all people with disabilities.
The signing of the bill and the addition of later amendments was seen as a monumental victory for people with disabilities who had previously run into obstacles like finding work, using public transportation, and accessing businesses.
We're joined now by two disability advocates who worked with leaders around Wisconsin and around the nation to help get the ADA signed. Dick Pomo is a retired disability advocate and human services professional. Dick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
And Michelle Martini is a project specialist with the Milwaukee-based organization Independence First. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's go back to the time before the ADA passed. And Michelle, you live with physical disabilities due to extreme rheumatism. What did you encounter before the ADA was law?
Well, I've had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis since I was about 2.5 years old. And, you know, I did all the things you're supposed to do, went through school, went to Whitewater, graduated from the university. And after graduating, I sat and watched my friends and my roommates and buddies all get positions while I tried and tried and tried and interviewed and interviewed. And, you know, people would ask me at the interview about my, I have limitations and some, you know, deformities from the arthritis. So they'd ask about my fingers, about surgeries, about my hip surgeries, just, you know, seemingly more fascinated with my disability than any of the skills I had to offer for employment, and that was absolutely legal. Right before, well, you know, 2.5 years of looking, and I just about had a position with a large national insurance company still around, and verbal offer, the whole bit. They were we were kind of finishing things with HR, and they called up. What would be my vocational rehab specialist, and said they were so sorry. They felt bad, but they were not going to be able to hire me because they just put somebody with rheumatoid arthritis just went on long-term disability, so they weren't going to hire me. And it was just truly devastating until I found a position then at Independence First.
And Dick, I want to bring you in on this now. As a person dealing with blindness, what kind of difficulties did you face in that similar situation, trying to get work or using things like public transportation prior to the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Well, some of the things that Michelle talked about certainly were things I experienced. Overall, many of us who sought employment before ADA and other legislation learned very quickly that no matter what you said, we had to try to sell our abilities. But at the same time, it forced us into some situations, in my case, trying to hide the vision loss. I did have some vision at the time, and I would go for an interview and try to hide it until it had to come out towards the end. I can remember one particular job, matter of fact, Milwaukee Public School System. In 1967, I went through the interview process, and they were looking for social workers at the time. I had a master's degree, and they were just dying to have master's degree social workers. And the fellow that interviewed me was very excited, probably mainly because I had the degree. And we got to the point where it sounded pretty good, and I shared the fact that I have a sight problem, and I am legally blind. And right then and there, it changed the attitude of the interview to say, you know, we're not sure that our parents would accept the fact someone who is legally blind working with our children. The ironic part of that was I went some 50 blocks down. Those people live in Milwaukee on Valeet Street, and began work with the Department of Social Services, which brought me in contact with problem youngsters and adults, and spent the first part of my career there. So even there, at times, people would make a decision based on what they thought my disability would limit me in doing, rather than finding out for me if there were any limitations.
And in the 1970s, Dick, you were involved with a group, or starting in the late 70s, you were with a group, the Wisconsin Disabilities Coalition. That's a while before the ADA ended up passing. What was this Wisconsin group trying to do at that time?
You know, one of the greatest things about the 70s was people with disabilities. In 1976, the White House formulated conference over the United States, and throughout the states, different groups were formed. In Wisconsin, from that effort, the Wisconsin Disability came about. And basically what it was is people with different disabilities coming together and saying, you know what, it's time we take destiny into our own hands. It's time we direct where we go. And certainly the help of other advocates gave us a chance. We spent many a Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning in different parts of the state, first of all, trying to find an accessible place to meet. And when we did, learning about each other, learning why we needed to work together and what was happening, why we were coming together, wasn't simply because we had disabilities. It was simply because our abilities were being discriminated against. And in Wisconsin, I think we can be very proud of people with disabilities that came together and said, we're not going to stop until we achieve equality.
Talking to Dick Pomo and Michelle Martini, both longtime disability advocates, as this weekend marks the 25th anniversary of the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, Michelle, how did you feel when you first found out that this act, the ADA, was being proposed in Congress?
Well, you know, I have to say I was starting to hear some things. I was relatively new in my career, and I was hearing about the ADA. I received one of the final drafts, or one of the drafts, I should say, first draft, and I stayed up the entire night reading it. I could not believe what I was reading. I mean, page after page, it would completely turn upside down the world of for many millions of people with disabilities as we knew it. And I couldn't believe that this was actually being proposed and that it might actually have a chance. I highly doubted it, but I threw myself heart and soul into advocating for it. It was very, very exciting time.
Michelle worked to advocate for it. Dick, you did as well. What kind of things did you encounter as you traveled to Wisconsin and to the nation's capital pushing for this act?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I hadn't been in Washington much. Kid from a small town in Connecticut, suddenly finding himself traveling around with my peers to different offices of Congress, and realizing that many of the people in Washington said to us, it's about time you people had a bill. And of course, our response was, wait a minute, let's talk about what we're asking for. We're not asking for a bill for us people. We're asking for a bill that simply allows us to participate in society like anybody else. And that took a little doing, because you know, if even at that time, one of the selling points I think most people, disability and advocates, were trying to sell was the fact that this law is more about ability than disability. And for some people, that's hard to comprehend. But, you know, we're not against, if we could eliminate disability, we would. We can't. But we can eliminate the fact that people are judged or kept from participating in a service because of their disability. And that's what the law basically set up, was to say you need to allow people the opportunity to participate in all aspects of society. And until that time, while there were some other laws, they were tied to funding, and ADA was not. So it was a comprehensive law that opened a lot of doors.
Talk about some of those doors that ended up being there in that bill, Dick, if you would.
One of the employment certainly it's still a problem, but it was one of the doors that was opened more by saying, when you hire somebody as an employer, you have the right to judge a person by establishing if they have the ability to perform the essential functions of a job. That's okay. But you can't make a determination based on a disability that simply the fact that the person cannot be hired because you don't believe they can do the job. The questions you needed to ask, you need to ask of everybody. I had a quick example of a situation where an employer asked me about how I would travel around the state and basically made their decision based on the fact that they felt it would be difficult because I would need to ride with other employees. The person that was hired 6 months later left the position because travel was too much. And I found out later they really didn't ask that person about travel. So the employers had to learn very quickly to say, if you're going to hire a person, let your interview be based on what are the essential functions of the job and direct your questions and your evaluation in that aspect.
We're talking with disability advocates Michelle Martini and Dick Pomo about the history of the Americans with Disabilities Act. They both advocated for the passage of that act. It turns 25 this Sunday.
And we want to hear from you. Did your life change because of the Americans with Disabilities Act? Do you have a question for either of our guests about their experiences? And what do you think still needs to be done to make sure people with disabilities get equal opportunities and services? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Wisconsin disability advocates Dick Pomo and Michelle Martini about the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we want to hear from you.
Did the ADA change your life? If you have a disability, what was your life like before the act passed? Were things better on the job and public transit and public accommodations after it passed? Call 800-642-1234. Now, Michelle, you were present, as I understand it, at the signing ceremony for the ADA. Can you talk us through that day?
Sure, I will. And I'd like to add a little bit more about what I see as some of the changes that still need to take place, to add to Dick's comment. But I'll first tell you about that day was, let me tell you, it was one of the best days, if not the best day of my life. It was an absolutely beautiful day on the South Lawn of the White House, military bands playing, lemonade stands, Senator Kennedy and dignitaries, bipartisan for both sides, senators, congressmen, other dignitaries, and people with every kind of disability you can imagine everywhere you look. I had tears in my eyes the entire time, and it was not out of sadness in any way. I was just so happy. It was hot and humid, but it was beautiful. You didn't even feel that. And then the other extremely impressive thing was there were bleachers in the back just filled with people. And at first I didn't know who the people all were. And then come to find out, I had asked somebody, and they were international press from all over the world, here to watch the United States, again, the leaders in human civil rights, pass a law like this. They wanted to witness this and hopefully bring that back in policy in their countries. And many of them stuck around to tour places within the U.S. after that.
And, Michelle, you mentioned changes or challenges that remain.
Well, I'll tell you, I think in the areas, well, we've made great access improvements in the area of access, physical improvements, curb cuts, parking spaces, in communications, in transportation, even though that was a very tough one to get by initially, in environmental changes. And those are all obvious, and they did cause money, but they're very visible and obvious, and many people can enjoy them and use them. But it's still employment that is very little to no change. As a matter of fact, 82.4% of the people with disabilities are still not working.
Wow.
and many of them want to, you know, as compared to 36% of the non-disabled. And I believe, and most people in Washington, I think many do, is that it's more a problem with perception and with attitude and fears. And, you know, there's nothing destroys misconceptions better than exposure. And the problem is we don't have enough people in the workplace to change that. That'll only change with that kind of exposure.
And, Michelle, I want to bring in one of our callers before we run out of time. We've got Jim on the line in Mayville. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to add something. My sister-in-law and brother find themselves disabled at a very young age. Mm-hmm. My sister-in-law had a severe car accident 20-plus years ago, and my brother-in-law had a stroke at age 48, which left him quite disabled. The point I really want to make is that the ADA has allowed them to live very independently, and we're so close to them. I'm almost in tears now, actually. We're so close to them, but we are so proud of them because they can function very well on a daily basis. And we don't have to worry about them too much. We're over there all the time helping them out, but really on a daily basis, they can function very well because of the ADA.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Dick, can you speak to that? Not just the people themselves, their family members get help here.
That's an excellent point. Thank you for the call, because that really sums up what ADA is about. You know, when we talk about ADA being part of a process, I can remember back in the late 70s, 1980s, when we fought in Wisconsin for attendant care. And we fought for the fact that people who were in nursing homes need not be there if there are services available.
Mm-hmm.
That was much before ADA, yet the principle was the same. It basically said, look, people have abilities that far go beyond their physical, mental, or other disabilities if they have the opportunity to use it. I learned very quickly after we worked hard and we partied hard as part of the Wisconsin Coalition, and I learned a very important lesson one evening when a friend of mine, about 10 o'clock at night, after meeting all day and spending a few toddies talking about the problems of the world, finally said to me, Dick, geez, could you please undo my top button of my shirt? And he had a tie on. Never gave a thought to that until I suddenly realized that, wait a minute, this person may need help getting out of bed in the morning, may need help getting into the wheelchair. But once he's there, or she's there, the rest of the day, they're able to function, and in this case, as an employee, as an advocate, and as a husband. It's because the services were put in place. And just quickly adding, if you watch your TV and you see the ads for the phones today where grandma's calling and grandma can be involved in the phone call because it's in text, 25 years ago we fought for that for people who were deaf or hard of hearing. But at the same time saying, just like curve ramps, if you provide this kind of service, other people will benefit from it. And I'll tell you what, somebody's making a lot of money on that service right now when they advertise on TV the ability for people who can't hear to communicate. And I think that's an important part of what ADA did.
And Michelle, very briefly, last word on this. What's the most important thing to tackle in the next 25 years?
Again, it's employment. And we have something like 76 baby boomers. They said 10,000 every day that turned 65. We need to really deal with this issue of employment, bringing more people into the workforce, and long-term care, providing the infrastructure and support to help allow people to live in the community.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dick, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Michelle Martini and Dick Pomo. They're both disability rights advocates involved in making the case for the Americans with Disabilities Act. They joined us to talk about the 25th anniversary of the signing of that act 25 years ago Sunday. One of Scott Walker's most high-profile rivals for the Republican presidential nomination is trying to score points with bicycle-riding Iowans this week. Donald Trump's campaign is handing out T-shirts and other goodies to some of the thousands of people riding in an annual Iowa bike ride known as Ragbri. Ragbri. I think that's how they pronounce it. Chuck Quirnbach has more on reaction to Trump and Walker.
Donald Trump has a big blue bus following the Ragbri riders at roadside stops, so at the end of the day's ride, a handful of volunteers stand near the bus and try to get people to accept Trump T-shirts, buttons, and, vital to most any bike rider, a bottle of cold water. One city the giveaway occurred was Storm Lake.
Free water. Who's thirsty? There you go. Courtesy of Mr. Trump.
Many people see the volunteers wearing Trump shirts and say, no thanks. But one Ragbri rider accepting the bottled water was a central Iowa resident who gave her name as Leanne. She says she likes Trump's candid conservative views.
I know he has a lot of things to say that are a little bit off the wall, you know, but at least he's bringing up issues that aren't brought up by the Republicans that aren't conservative.
Trump's critics say he's more than a bit off the wall, with his attacks on Latinos and GOP Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, just to name a few targets. But Storm Lake resident and Trump water drinker Emil Lyko says Trump's criticism of undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. suits him just fine.
You know, I agree we used to live in Arizona. I think tightening up our borders is important. I think that we need to stand up and become, you know, you can't be a strong country by just saying, hey, you know what? Everybody come in and do whatever you want.
Lyko says he does wish Trump would pause a little before answering questions. Trump's outspokenness has some Republicans wishing he'd drop out of the presidential race, fearing Trump can't win the nomination or will hurt the GOP with independents in next year's general election. A Des Moines resident who gave his name as Dale and says he's an independent is turned off by Trump.
He just seems to pull the trigger a little quick, I think. Doesn't seem to want to think things through and seems to have his foot in the wrong place a lot of times.
But if the billionaire businessman stays in, his brashness could make other GOP candidates look more appealing. Emil Lyko's wife, Karen Lyko, says she's considering Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
He seems honest. It's hard to tell these days. But, I mean, he seems honest and sincere about what he says, and we're just keeping our eyes on everybody right now.
The central Iowa resident, Leanne, says she's also watching Walker.
He's proven what he's been able to do in Wisconsin, and I feel that if he stays conservative, I think we'll be okay, and he might be the candidate, I don't know, but you have to just keep watching him weekly and make sure things, you know, his values stay the same.
The Walker campaign did not respond to our inquiry about Trump's bus and the giveaways to the bicycle riders. But when he was in Iowa last weekend, Governor Walker not only criticized Trump's comments about John McCain, but told reporters that he, Walker, has victories in government.
Well, I think the difference between me and anybody else is, again, there's winners and there's fighters. Some people who are good at fighting on things but have yet to win those big fights, at least when it comes to public policy.
That may win Walker voters in the long run. But for now, Donald Trump is getting attention one bottle at a time. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Storm Lake, Iowa.